Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I'll begin today's lecture, not with Thomas Aquinas directly, but with a line from C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters. It's the first on your handout. I just have a couple of lines that I wanted to highlight for you all. If you know the text, Screwtape, you know that it consists of a series of letters from a senior devil named Screwtape to his nephew, Wormwood, trying to explain to him how to win for the devil the soul of a man whom he refers to in the book only as the patient. The ninth letter contains some very striking advice, which I'll read now. "Never forget," says Screwtape, "when we are dealing with any pleasure in its healthy and normal and satisfying form, we are, in a sense, on the enemy's ground." Remember, the enemy here is God himself. "I know we have won many a soul through pleasure. All the same, it is his invention, not ours. He made the pleasures. All our research so far has not enabled us to produce one. All we can do is to encourage the humans to take the pleasures which our enemy has produced at times, or in ways or in degrees which he has forbidden. Hence, we always try to work away from the natural condition of any pleasure to that in which it is least natural, least redolent of its maker, and least pleasurable." Nice kicker at the end, right? What Screwtape sees is, in my judgment, something he could have learned from Thomas Aquinas, that pleasure is an important part of a naturally good human life, and more than that, that the right kind of experience of pleasure is crucial to keeping us in touch with our natural ends. Now, I chose this topic. I thought this is a topic that I like to speak about to Thomistic Institute audiences, not only because it's a theme of Thomas Aquinas's work, although I take that to be a sufficient reason to look at it, but also because it's something I fear we've lost sight of, especially in the modern world. It's not that we don't have our pleasures, far from it, but that there is something unhealthy about the way that we approach and experience pleasure. So there are two tendencies that I detect, and I detect these sometimes just among my students, right? When I say I detect them, I mean I detect them in myself too, but certainly in my students as they approach their own lives. Two tendencies that seem contradictory at first, but that it seems to me fit together in a complicated way. First, there's a kind of hedonism so prominent and so strong that it pervades our whole world. Throbbing consumerism, constant focus on getting more of the comforts of life, packing pleasure into our brain with a constant stream of advertising and distraction and videos. We can see a kind of immersion in immediate pleasure throughout our lives. We can see in just common social life, there's an immersion of so many young people in pleasure, so many older people too. And then we see some extreme examples like the appeal of drugs, right, which invites sort of extreme experiences of pleasure. But on the other hand, and going with that and in some ways intensifying it, it seems to me that there's a distance from genuine pleasure, an inability to experience it with a pure, clear-sighted mind, right? We all know how many people are, I mean, maybe not all of us, but I certainly know many people who are workaholics, right, who immerse their life in finishing the next task, completing the next problem, without any real capacity to experience leisure or to understand and appreciate the genuine goods present in their own lives. So to my mind, those two tendencies are not separate, but they're two sides of the same coin. on the one hand, a failure to understand what's pleasant about a decent, virtuous life that's led people to retreat to extreme options in their spare time while not appreciating the goodness of a natural, decently lived life as a whole. And I would suggest to you that to appreciate pleasure properly, what we need most is a return to nature in the sense of human nature. That's going to be my main theme today. Nature as something and human nature as something that provides pleasure. Now, another tendency I have seen, again, among students and scholars and intellectuals, is one that sees suffering and pain as the only way to take yourself seriously. Life, you know, pain is the obvious counterpart to pleasure. And it too, I do not deny for a moment, has an important role in human life and in coming to self-understanding. But those who think that the meaning of life is disclosed to us only through painful experience, only through suffering, seem to me to be missing an important part of the truth, right? That it's not only in existential anguish that we discover who we really are, but also in the enjoyments that belong to us through nature. And so without diminishing and without meaning to diminish the importance of pain in a full life, and I'm happy to take that up afterwards in the questions if anyone is interested, what I want to do is to explain how pleasure too, a properly cultivated sense of enjoyment, plays a role in a well-lived human life and helps us understand life's meaning. And it's my opinion that in our age, counterintuitively, we're actually more likely, I would say my students frequently are more likely to misunderstand the importance of pleasure in a fully lived life than they are of pain. Now, as I was saying a moment ago, to return to pleasure is in some ways to return to nature. To experience pleasure properly is in some ways to return to nature. Not in the sense of going out into the woods, there's nothing wrong with that, it's a fine thing, but in the sense of getting back to who we are as human beings. Getting back to a world in which we understand ourselves as purposeful, purposive, morally oriented, godly creatures. For Thomas, and my thesis in a way is that Thomas's view of this and Thomas's account of this can help us see this more fully and more completely. When human beings fulfill a natural function, for Thomas, they properly take pleasure in it. Underlying that thought is the thought that pleasure is the belief that nature is good, that the goods toward which nature leads us as human beings are all ordained by God, set for us by God. When we attain a natural good, when we do things that conduce to the attainment of a natural good, there is an automatic, healthy feeling of pleasure that goes along with it. So to take the very simplest example, human beings enjoy eating when they're hungry, right? That's proper for Thomas, and it's a token of God's providence over creation, which includes his governance of the human body in its needs and its directedness. Against Thomas's position stands the position of the Manichaeans. Here I'll quote something from early in the Summa. This is not in your handout, but this is from the Prima Pars, Question 8, Article 3. I'll read slowly because I didn't put it on the handout. Thomas wrote, "Now there were some, the Manichaeans, who said that spiritual and incorporeal things were subject to divine power, but that visible and corporeal things were subject to the power of a contrary principle. Therefore, against these, it is necessary to say that God is in all things by his power." Contrary to the Manichaean thesis, Thomas refuses to see in the created world, including the bodily world, including the human body, the realization of an evil principle, opposed to God's will from the beginning, that becomes mixed into God's creation and that human beings simply need to oppose. Rather, he sees nature, including physical nature, as having been created by God and as having in it a tendency toward the good. The goods of the body, which include the goods of eating and sexuality, and even in moderation, all these in moderation, we'll get to that in a minute, even those of intoxicating drink are genuine goods that can be enjoyed in moderation. The pleasure that we experience is a token of God's providence over our natural lives. Beyond those simple bodily pleasures, the ones connected with their natural functions, Thomas also indicates that there are certain pleasures that we need to learn to appreciate properly. Aristotle, Thomas's great teacher, had spoken of the pleasures that accompany the virtuous life as especially important. In fact, one sign that a person is living well, one sign that a person is living virtuously, is that he or she has inculcated correct habits of virtue. That is, it's a sign of living well that you do virtuous actions willingly and even take pleasure in them. I'm aware this may not be true in every case. Again, in the questions, we can talk about those virtuous actions that are, I'll say a little bit about this at the end. We can talk a little bit about those pleasures that are intrinsic, that carry with them pains, the pleasure, the actions that have to do especially with courage and suffering on behalf of something good. But the ordinary warp and woof of the moral life consists in the ability to do virtuous things and to take proper pleasure in having done those virtuous things. And it's a sign of a well-formed soul that it takes pleasure in doing what is right. So with that as the kind of setup of my talk, there are two things that I want to do in the remainder of tonight's lecture. First, I'm just going to talk at some more length about what pleasure is. I'm going to try to define it, show how it's good, show how it's part of a well-lived natural life, and say a few words about its connection to the natural law. Once we've done that, I want to start with that, as I've said, because I think it's especially important for us to come to appreciate the good that pleasure is. I'm going to turn in the second major part of the talk to talk about the problem of pleasure. Why it is that we need virtues, habituated virtues, acquired virtues, and in the highest case, even infused virtues regulating our disposition toward it. Namely, why we need a virtue like temperance and it doesn't simply naturally inhere in us. With those two things in mind, you could say my overall purpose is to stake out a kind of defense of the moderate, sensible embrace of pleasure as part of a good human life. So big part one, pleasure and nature. So we need to begin by asking, as we explore Thomas's account of these things, what does Thomas understand by pleasure? The word in Latin is delectatio, which is sometimes translated as delight, including in parts of the rendering that you're probably most familiar with. This summa is translated by the English Dominican fathers. Sometimes the word voluptas is the word for pleasure. That's actually more ordinarily used in Thomas's commentary on the Ethics. But the typical word for pleasure is delectatio. I'm just going to stick with pleasure and its cognates to refer to that. Thomas first addresses pleasure in the Summa as one of the three divisions of the good, together with the useful and the virtuous or honest. The Latin word is just honesto. It doesn't mean narrowly what we mean by honest when we talk about truth-telling, but I'll read his definition of that in a second. It means the quality that belongs to moral acts as such. Honorable is a way you could translate that to virtuous, honorable, honest. Those three things are not, for Thomas, simply equal species of the good existing side by side as partitions of the whole. Rather, they have a hierarchical relation to one another. of those three goods, the useful is always understood in terms of its contribution to something further. It's desirable, quote, as the means by which something tends toward another. In other words, the useful is not something that human beings want for its own sake, but because it leads to something or contributes to something that we do want for its own sake. So you take medicine for your cold, not because you like the taste, but because you hope to be healthy. Very simple. So utility is always understood in terms of these other goods, right? It doesn't even make sense without them. The pleasant and the honest, the virtuous, meanwhile, have a somewhat more complicated relationship. The virtuous, Thomas says, is what is desired for its own sake as the termination of human desire. The pleasant, meanwhile, is the good that is experienced when one's appetite comes to rest in its object. To put that somewhat more simply, the honest, the honorable, the virtuous is the thing that human beings most want, right? Pleasure, or that not just human beings, but beings most want. Pleasure is the experience that comes along with feeling your desire for that thing sated, right? Now, when Thomas first sketches out his three-pronged definition or his three-pronged account of what the good is, he's thinking about it primarily in terms of, it's actually a part of his discussion of God's attributes, right? So he's thinking about it in the most high-minded possible way. From that point of view, I'm happy to take this up afterwards, but from that point of view, it seems to me, the virtuous is understood as the thing which human beings most want. But pleasure is something that goes along with the satisfaction of any desire, including desires that are not for the very highest things, including desires for, you could say, subordinate good, right? Subordinate goods, rather. The best kind of pleasure for Thomas is the one that comes from acquiring the highest good, the honestum good. And when one does that, there's a feeling of pleasure that goes along with it. And that capacity to feel pleasure is implanted by God. Now, according to Thomas, it's only animate beings. Beings with minds, intelligent beings, you could say, that are capable of experiencing pleasure. In a simple sense, of course, that makes sense. To feel pleasure, you need to be sentient. You need to have enough of a soul to be aware that you're feeling something. We can't really imagine a rock or water feeling pleasure. We can't even really imagine, maybe, we could argue about this later, I'm not sure, difficult to imagine even a plant feeling pleasure, right? When we talk about beings that feel pleasure, we mean especially human beings and animals, right? So the capacity to experience pleasure is something in the first place that human beings have in common with the lower animals. But Thomas makes a distinction in the kinds of pleasure that we are able to experience. Here I'll say another, this is another somewhat, I hope not bland, but somewhat technical point. While all intelligent beings are capable of experiencing pleasure, the manner in which they experience it depends on the particular kind of being that they are. Thomas identifies a certain kind of pleasure as gaudium. The word is usually translated as joy. If you guys know Latin school songs, right? The old song, Gaudeamus Igitur, right? Let us rejoice, therefore, while we are young. The famous graduation song from, I think, Oxford or something like that, right? But a famous Latin graduation song. Joy, Thomas suggests, is the particular form of pleasure, a subset of pleasure as a whole that creatures who have reason are able to experience. That makes it different from the pleasures shared by the animals. Thomas carefully notes that all pleasures, both those shared by the lower animals and those unique to reasoning beings, can be the object, of gaudium, right? So with that, let me just read. Gaudium comes, or joy, as it's usually rendered, comes from reason's awareness that a good and a proper good has been achieved. Following John Damascene and Gregory of Nyssa, Thomas says that the difference between mere delight and the kind of delight we call joy comes down to the fact that joy is a pleasure of the rational soul, whereas the other kinds of pleasures can be present in the body. Or to be more precise about that, there are some pleasures that belong only to the intellectual soul, where others belong to the sensible soul. The pleasure of the soul, this gaudium or joy, is a movement of the intellectual appetite. Let me just make sure I've explained this clearly for a second, right? So according to Thomas, there's the simple pleasure that human beings experience in their body. There are also pleasures of the reason. Those pleasures of reason exist when we apprehend that we have acquired or attained some good. That kind of joy can extend to things like recognizing that the pleasures of the body are good for us, right? So if we're hungry and we eat something, we both feel pleasure on an animal level in that a simple desire is satisfied, but also can experience pleasure on a rational level, understanding that we have done something that conduces to a legitimate end, in this case, feeding and sustaining ourselves. And so reason, as it were, ratifies and takes its own pleasure in the simple deed that we have done, right? So reason has, you could say, and this is the kind of thing, I know this is a somewhat technical point, but in some ways it's important to everything I'm trying to argue tonight, because part of what I want to convey is that we can recognize even these simple animal goods. If we properly understand what we are as human beings, if we properly understand what our purpose is, even these simple animal goods have a kind of genuine worth that our reason is capable of apprehending. Okay? We can talk about that later if it's not. And I quote here, this is just to explain that last point I make quoting from Thomas. This is also not on your sheet. But this is the Summa Prima Secundae, question 31, article 4, where Thomas has a short treatise on pleasure. He writes, "Now, whatever we desire naturally can also be the object of reasoned desire and delight, but not vice versa. Consequently, whatever can be the object," so not vice versa means we can't have a physical longing for understanding, right? Like our body isn't going to long to understand in the same way that our mind wants to understand. "Consequently, whatever can be the object of delight can also be the object of joy in rational beings. And yet everything is not always the object of joy, since sometimes one feels a certain delight in the body without rejoicing thereat according to reason. And accordingly, delight extends to more things than does joy." I'm going to come back to that point in a minute, right? It's possible to enjoy something with one's body and disapprove of it with one's mind. But the point I want to make here is that even bodily pleasure admits of two somewhat different valences. In the first place, there's the simple reaction in the human soul to feeling bodily pleasure. But on the other hand, or together with that, there's an intellectual apprehension of the goods that we experience in our body. And that is a source of joy. That is a source of pleasure that is present in our will when it apprehends something as good. There would be pleasures, then, that are not only pleasant for the body, but also known by the soul to be good for it and therefore ratified by it. what I would say is that this is the space in which many of the important pleasures of our life take place. The satisfaction that we get from simple things like eating and drinking, sustaining ourselves, takes on a new and higher meaning when it's understood in light of the purposiveness of God's creation. Right? Let me put this then a different way. In a key part of the Summa, Thomas describes, what maybe you will know everything about, what he calls the natural law. That's the famous, one of the most famous parts of his teaching, and one of the things that you find very clearly in Thomas that's absent from, say, Aristotle, right? A sense that nature itself, without God's particular revelation, without the intervention of the divine will, gives us certain purposes and presents a certain order to our lives. Like all beings, human beings seek to preserve themselves. Like the animals, they seek to perpetuate their species. And because they are rational beings, they are impelled also to live in communities and to seek to know God. Those are the three prongs of Thomas's famous hierarchy of the natural law: directedness towards self-preservation, towards preservation of the species, and then toward the cultivation of our region, which bifurcates into life and community and an attempt to know God. Each of those natural ends carries with it certain concomitant pleasures. We preserve ourselves by eating, and we rightly take pleasure in eating. We perpetuate the species through our sexuality and rightly take pleasure when it's done in an appropriate way with those sorts of pleasures too. We come to practice the virtues, finally, both the moral virtues and the intellectual virtues, through our rational capacities. And we rightly take pleasure when we do find things and when we make progress in our understanding. In each case, the goods ordained by nature are betokened by pleasures that we experience as we pursue them in the right way. And we appreciate those pleasures best, in my opinion, or to put that somewhat differently, we best understand our condition as we best understand the condition of our nature. We best understand ourselves as human beings when we see how those ordinary pleasures made possible for us through God's very act of creation point us to our proper natural ends. So there's the first big suggestion I wanted to make. For Thomas, God has created nature and framed human life in such a way that it's accompanied by proper pleasures. Our reason can confirm that what we are doing is good, that we should enjoy it in its proper measure. The pleasures that we feel come from God's beneficence in the act of creation and ought to be embraced accordingly. So that's the end of part one. Maybe a simpler way to convey all of this, I know I went through a few euphemistic things, is to go back to the Screwtape letters, right? There's a wonderful chapter in there where Screwtape warns Wormwood against allowing the patient to read a book for fun or go for a walk for fun, right? Like that simple real connection with his life as lived, with his real wants, not the ones that live in the eyes of others, not the ones that come from vanity, right? Not the desire to increase his reputation or make a profit, but that simple natural taste for reading in the first place, for a walk and a drink in the other place, is for him something that brings him back to who he naturally is. And for Screwtape, it's when that patient is who he naturally is that he's most at risk of going to Screwtape's enemy, as it were, that is, finding his way to divine, to God, okay? But, so that, presenting, having presented that much, things sound perhaps very clean and simple, right? But we all know, I certainly know, that that's only half the story. pleasure is experienced by us not only as a token of the goodness of our life or God's creation, but also as a problem. It requires the cultivation of a specific virtue, which Thomas calls temperance, to acquire the proper disposition toward it. That doesn't happen automatically, but entails habituation and training, and even then, the problem does not go away. Even the most virtuous individuals wrestle with temptation, and at least some of those who live with God's grace wrestle with temptation. So what I want to do in the second part is speak about what I'm calling the problem of pleasure, right? On the one hand, I think getting back in touch with pleasure is necessary to a good education. On the other hand, we only go halfway by recognizing, in a very obvious way, we need to do justice to the other part, which is the problematic nature of pleasure. Now, for Thomas, the moral virtues, the ones that have to do with training our character, all require, in one way or another, a kind of habituation. Acquiring temperance, being able to enjoy pleasure in the right way, requires some training. That's because there is something in the disposition of the human soul, as we know it now, that is not simply oriented toward the good. Here, I'll quote a passage from Joseph Pieper's Four Cardinal Virtues. I believe this is on your handout. It's a short one, right? Pieper, if you don't know him, is a German Catholic philosopher. I would say one of the very few great Thomists of the 20th century. There are other great ones, but his treatises on these things were a very important influence on Pope Benedict. And his books, I really find every time I return to them, I find I learn something profound. Here's what he says. He writes, "It is a commonplace, though nonetheless mysterious truth, that man's inner order, unlike that of the crystal, the flower, or the animal, is not a simply given and self-evident reality, but rather that the same forces from which human existence derives its being can upset the inner order to the point of destroying the moral, the spiritual and moral person." In other words, we do not experience the pleasures we have in common with the animals as simple goods, always pursued in their proper measure, always serving those natural ends that Thomas had spoken about. Rather, we experience them as good in a way, but also as temptations, frequently desired beyond their proper measure, and if indulged, capable of throwing off our whole moral balance. In other words, we do not experience our nature, do not experience human nature as something that automatically takes on, naturally, you could say, takes on the right shape in the way that a flower automatically grows from a bud. We experience it rather as something that needs disciplining and control, that we need to bring under the reins of reason by long habituation, and even then, in most cases, it requires continual self-overcoming. The cause of all of this, in Thomas's account, is original sin, right? And that becomes, this is in a way, the wrench in the gears of the functioning of nature, right? Human beings are not now, in their fallen condition, inclined always to act in accord with their reason. Rather, as Thomas puts it when explaining his account of the, what he calls, fulmes of sin in the discussion of law, says, quote, "By the just sentence of God, man is destitute of original justice, and his reason bereft of its rigor." Original justice is the condition of human beings in the state of integral nature. That is, the state in which human beings existed in the garden before the fall. And now, weighted down by the foamies of sin, we find we have an impulse of sensuality. Again, that's Thomas's term from the same questions. It's a, question, prima secundae, question 91, article 6, right? We find we have an impulse of sensuality that draws us away from the life lived in accord with reason. What I would say is still the most memorable description of that experience, that fact in recorded literature, is in St. Paul's Epistle to the Romans, the famous chapter 7. He there describes a law in his members. Members is meros in Greek, or mere in the plural. So parts, right, as though it's present in his body itself. So he describes a law in his members which opposes the law of the spirit, the law that his reason recognizes as the proper one to follow. And even St. Paul, depending how you read it, but I would read it, as indicating that even St. Paul, at his late stage in life, infused apparently with God's grace, given these remarkable gifts of preaching to convert the whole world, lives with a tension in his heart because he still finds it riven by the appeal of illicit pleasure. And so our relationship with pleasure is going to be more complicated than it is for the other animals, and more complicated than it was for Adam and Eve. We start from the fundamental fact, or pleasure comes to us, first of all, with our through our awareness of the fundamental fact that what our reason tells us and what our bodies tell us does not perfectly align. To put it strongly, that's the way in which we experience original sin. The phenomenological element in original sin, that is the lived experience of original sin, is what we feel when we recognize a higher law, spiritual law, as Paul describes it, to which we find ourselves unable to live up. Now, as Thomas notes throughout this discussion, the primary issue in St. Paul, primary issue that he describes when he describes the power of original sin, primary issue that temperance has to address is the problem of bodily pleasures, and precisely those connected with their animal nature that I was trying to speak about and even celebrate before. He says that the pleasures directed toward preservation, both of self and species, so both the pleasures of food and drink and the pleasures of sex, are the strongest pleasure. Our body and even our soul long for those pleasures, whatever our reason might tell us. Indulgence in those kinds of pleasures, for Thomas, threatens to upset with it the order of all the other virtues. We recognize that our nature, our desiring, somewhat good but also sinful nature, needs to be brought into check. Thomas even notes that improper indulgence in bodily pleasure will cause us to lose our capacity for moral judgment. The Greek word for moderation is sophrosune, and if you take that down to its etymological roots, so Aristotle suggests, maybe it's a full etymology, it means something like preserving prudence, preserving good judgment, right? So someone who indulges excessively in any of the pleasures of the body, be they food or sex, runs the risk of losing not only doing terrible things, but losing the capacity to see properly what the things that ought to be done are. In other words, the bodily pleasures are so powerful that they run the risk of corrupting our soul and our mind so much that we cease to be virtuous individuals and lose all of that, right? So this broadly is what I would call the other half, or the other aspect of Thomas's teaching on pleasure. Right? It's at the same time the other half of his teaching on nature. Everything I said in the first half about the goodness of pleasure and the goodness of God's creation and the bodily pleasures needs to be taken together with Thomas's claim that original sin has dislodged us from our original justice, our original condition, our original integral condition, in such a way that forever after, pleasure is going to be, as long as human beings remain in their fallen condition, human beings will be forced to wrestle with the attraction of the pleasures and constantly seek to overcome that. In other words, the attraction for pleasure is, on the one hand, a sign of God's generosity to us, but on the other hand, in its excesses and in its immeasuredness, a sign of human sinfulness. So what does one do with all of that? I want to kind of try. So with those two main ideas in mind, I want to kind of try to bring this, I hope, relatively quickly to a close. On the one hand, Thomas does recognize the importance of pleasure as an essential piece of a well-lived life, as part of what makes human beings happy. As part of God's creation, it's necessary, as much as possible, to remain in contact with the natural hierarchy of ends, and human beings have certain natural purposes. On the other hand, original sin has disfigured us in such a way that we are constantly going to be competing with ourselves or battling ourselves to keep an excessive taste for pleasure under control, right? I suppose if there's one broad thesis that I wanted to convey in all of this, it's that moderation toward pleasure, right, involves not a rejection of pleasure as such, right? Not in an unwillingness to embrace the goods of this life, but in an appreciation that they need to be embraced with measure, right? And measure means neither rejecting them blindly nor embracing them as though they were our only good. Pleasure, while it's so often a source of temptation, is also part of the connective tissue that God, in his act of creation, has established between human life as it's ordinarily lived and the highest end of human beings, their naturally, divinely given purpose. Properly regulated, properly attuned, it's a way of maintaining a connection between the human being and God. Now, with all of that in mind, there's one last thing that I want to address, something I haven't yet. It's also true that Thomas, in his account of pleasure, leaves some space for virtues that transcend the requirements of nature that he describes. Those are virtues like celibacy, like extreme fasting, where human beings deny themselves natural goods over a long period of time. Catholics ordinarily practice this, again, in measure with things like Lenten sacrifices or other ordinary mortifications, right? Those aren't just instances where one exercises restraint in order to acquire good habits and avoid excess. They're instances where one foregoes the natural good entirely. In those cases, Thomas says, one is in fact released from the obligation, and he does call it an obligation, so it's a duty, the obligation to fulfill the natural law by procreating, but one does it not to indulge oneself, right? One doesn't refrain from these things in order to gain some greater worldly pleasure, but in order to serve God more completely. To understand this thought, it's crucial to see that Thomas's appreciation of the ascetic, the supernatural ascetic virtues, comes not from the vice of insensibility and inability to experience or consider pleasure in its proper measure, nor does it come from a Manichaean belief that the created world, the physical world, is evil and ought to be rejected. It comes rather from an awareness of a good greater than any other to which one wants to devote oneself completely. That is, of course, the life that Thomas chose for himself. For ordinary folk like myself, those kinds of extreme practices might look like burdens. In the best cases, though, it doesn't quite look that way. So here in closing, I'd like to quote one more time from Joseph Pieper. This is not on your hand. He writes, "If we regard the Christian notion of temperance from the angle of pain, a sterner face rises behind the foreground of creational joy, a face molded by the decision to relinquish the created for the sake of the Creator. But this sterner face also radiates an assenting joy, immeasurably above all ingenuous rejoicing in the created. To apply another line from Thomas, grace does not destroy but perfects nature, and we appreciate the supernatural and the supernatural goods best when we do so on the basis of a genuine understanding of what is good in God's creation. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.